The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show first broadcast by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Good morning and welcome to this Fresh FM meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous On Air. I'm Kim and I'm an alcoholic and I'm your chair for this meeting. We will open the meeting with the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, organisation or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses or opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The topic for this meeting is the promises. And I'll just read that now from the AA Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's page 83. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realise that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialise if we work for them. Richard, could I ask you to open the sharing, please?
Thank you, Kim. I'm Richard. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Richard.
Grateful to be here today, sober, and thank you for the invite. The promises, how they have materialised in my life. I sit here today, sober, healthy, happy, married, employed, and without a arrest warrant pending. And at one time that wasn't so. And for that, I'm really, really grateful to live a sober life today. My experience, strength and hope is, and even growing up, I felt different. I grew up in a dysfunctional family. My father was an alcoholic. And even before I remember picking up a drink at 12 years old, I felt different. I felt full of fear, living in a fantasy of wishing something was different. Things would change. If only I had this, if only I had that, to try and make me feel happy and content in life. Around that 12, 13 years old, I started drinking. Alcohol was available in my house to sneak a few drinks, but also the crowd that I grew up with, that was an ambition in the weekends especially, to get some beer and drink it as fast as possible to get as drunk as possible. And there I felt like I belonged. I felt, that 10-foot tall and bulletproof expression. And my fear went away, and I fitted in, and it was fun. And my drinking was just sort of controlled due to the fact of inability to get it often or have the money. By the time I was 15 and 16 years old and able to fund it myself, it became very regular and very reliant on having a good time. I needed alcohol. And that through my teenage years, I developed the need to be able to control it, to control it so I could get to work, so I would have enough money, and control it so I didn't get into trouble with it, and I failed dismally. Time I got into my 20s, I was trying to stop it, and by then, I was always trying to recapture the days when it used to give me a lot of joy and fun and feeling, you know, like I belonged. It was now turning on me where I didn't feel I fitted in because people didn't want me around, that I was causing trouble everywhere I went, and I was causing a lot of discomfort and hurt to people that I loved. And then that guilt and remorse and sadness started getting into my drinking, where I wasn't happy sober, but I wasn't happy drunk. And my whole demeanour started to change. So I tried to stop drinking, and which I was able to do so for a wee while. It was usually at the end of a bad binge or getting arrested or some real drama. And I'd repair myself for a week or two and get back to work, feel better, you know, get back home, start paying some bills. And then that insidious insanity that they say alcoholism is used to come into my head, and I forget about all the consequences of my drinking. And I started feeling the stress of life sober, and, you know, that inability to be able to cope with life on life's terms. And I'd fool myself that I'd just go out and have a couple. And then as soon as I picked up that drink again, I set off that allergy of the body that they say that one drink's too many and a thousand's not enough. And off I'd go again on another binge. And that happened through my 20s till I got to 28 and got another DIC charge. And I got an ultimatum through the mother of my children that was different from all others. And it made me have a look at my life of where I was going, and it certainly wasn't what I would have planned out to be. And I sought help through a counsellor who just happened, by the grace of God, had worked in a recovery centre, and I found myself there, you know, 3 weeks later, and being introduced again to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I say again, as when I was 19 years old, due to breaking the law, I was dished out prohibition, because back then, you know, I was 20 years old to be able to go into pubs and things, but I was 19, I wasn't allowed into any premises that sold alcohol. I was on probation, and my probation officer was really keen or insistent that I attended an AA meeting, and I went along to get the chit that, you know, I had attended AA. And as I didn't want it then, I found all the reasons just on the wall that was enough for me, you know, not to want it. You know, the word God, which today I've discovered is, you know, general overall director, a God of my own understanding today, a spiritual support and solution. But that gave me enough evidence that no, AA wasn't going to work for me. But the difference was, 9, 10 years later, when I was 28, I was desperate. I was desperate enough to take whatever was going to be on offer. And I started to listen. And they say when you first go to AA meetings, go to quite a few, go to different ones, pick out the similarities, leave the differences. And all those little sayings in AA that can really bug you at the beginning, that they really help when you need them. And I started to hear my story. I started to hear other people who thought like I did, that had the problems I had with life, and I started to get the solution to be able to live life without having to pick up a drink. And just little blessings like one day at a time. Just get through today. Don't worry about tomorrow. You know. There's lots of and many different sayings in Alcoholics Anonymous. But if you keep coming back, just say one day at a time without picking up a drink, things change in my life. And today, working through the 12 steps, you know, I've been able to be relieved from all the anxieties and the fear about why I had to drink in the first place. And I now sit here today, you know, 32 years later, a very grateful alcoholic for what I'm blessed with today. Thanks very much, Kim, for asking me to share.
Thanks very much, Richard.
Thank you, Richard.
You're listening to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on air. If you want more information or help to stop drinking, please call 0800 229 6757 or go to the website aa.org.nz.
Sarah, would you like to share?
Thanks, Kim. My name is Sarah and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sarah.
I grew up in a post-World War II fairly low socioeconomic family, and my parents were of very diverse cultures. There was such a huge difference between religion, politics, even the food we ate. And I quickly learned that if I did the right thing for the right person, I was recognized and I was approved of. But I also realized that making mistakes was just not acceptable in my family. And I developed a lot of nervous maladies, asthma, tummy aches, all that sort of thing. And life just kind of went on. My parents didn't drink often, just on major occasions. But some of my uncles and cousins were clearly alcoholics, and ultimately my youngest brother was an alcoholic. And when I was given my first taste of alcohol, I was very young in primary school, and I just felt like I could relax. I didn't have to worry about what everyone was thinking and how I had to perform and what I had to take care of. It was quite magical. Fortunately, I did not have a lot of opportunities to get my hands on alcohol. In those days, it was sold in stores that the government ran, and it was behind locked glass cabinets, so an underage kid couldn't even get in the door. But somehow I managed to gravitate towards other children that felt like I did, and whenever we had the opportunity, we would swipe whatever we could. Sometimes it was cough medicine. Sometimes it was wine or bourbon. And we'd hide it in the woods in a big mason jar. And when we thought we had enough, we'd sit around and drink this hideous concoction and stagger around in the woods giggling and sober up and go home. We really had no idea why we were doing it. It was just fun. And then as alcohol became more available in my teenage years, I could socialize better. I could sleep better. My studies got easier. And alcohol became really the solution to my problems. I was never a daily drinker. I was never a gutter drunk. I could not begin to hold my liquor like the men of my family could. So it didn't occur to me that alcohol was a problem. But by early 20s, I developed ulcers. I had quickly married and had three children and gravitated towards very high-pressure jobs, accomplishment being how I measured my worth. And little by little, the drinking became less and less of a social thing and more of almost a medication. I started to drink by myself. I started to hide. I knew I couldn't work or do anything responsibly the day after I drank, so I would very carefully try to control it. And although I would control when I drank, I could never seem to control how much I drank. If it was available, I started out for a glass or two of wine, and whatever was there was gone. And the next day, I didn't have any understanding of why I had done that. I had large spaces between my drinking. With my stomach problems, I couldn't keep much down, but I would carefully wait for a certain amount of time and then just gleefully spend a night annihilating myself. It stopped me from worrying. It let me sleep. It stopped my stomach from hurting until the next day, and then I was deathly ill. Ultimately, my youngest brother was dying of alcoholism, and I was directed to Al-Anon because I was just beside myself. I'd had huge spaces in my drinking. Why could he not give it up for a few days? He was very much an all-day, everyday drinker. And in Al-Anon, I started to learn about the disease of alcoholism. I knew about the medical model. What I didn't understand was the cravings that began with that first drink. I didn't like the taste of it, and yet I would belt down a drink so I could drink some more. And that started to make sense to me, and I realized that for my health, if nothing else, I needed to stop drinking. And friends in Al-Anon suggested I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was appalled. I couldn't see myself as an alcoholic. I was well-groomed. I was well-educated. I got the job done. I raised the family. And yet I sat in those rooms afraid to pick up the next drink. And all I heard was a day at a time, a day at a time. And I thought, well, I can do that. I've done it before. And they said, yes, but you've stopped many times, but did you ever stay stopped? And of course, I had to admit that I hadn't. And for a long time, I looked at the people around me and listened to their stories and found whatever I could to separate myself from them. You know, I don't have your fashion sense. I'm better educated. And I was either better or worse. And I didn't take in the real meanings of what they were saying, but I was afraid not to keep coming back. And I found that people were bright-eyed and laughing, and life for me was struggling and suffering and never being able to quite pay the bills on time. And just one fear factor after another. And these folks had not only stopped drinking, but they seemed to have a real grip on life. And more than anything, that's what appealed to me. I had a lot of confusing religious mores in my background, and the idea of a God of my own understanding really appealed to me because I did believe there had to be something bigger than me. There just had to. And yet I felt like everything was my responsibility. I took an awful lot of blame, and I blamed others. But a very kind woman approached me one day and told me that she thought I really needed a strong sponsor. And she guided me through the steps. And, you know, just awareness started to happen. I started to sort of wake up to what was reality instead of what I thought life had to be. And little by little, I was able to appreciate those around me, to contribute, constantly thinking I was starting to get the answers. And as soon as I did, I'd graduate. I'd be out. I'd be done. And I'm here to say I've been there for a very, very long time. And the things I have learned about how to live life literally on life's terms without financial fears, without fears of what people think, without recrimination from a higher power that's going to punish me and things like that. It's just such a huge life changer. My body's healed. My mind is in much better shape. I no longer want to just obliterate myself. And life is joyful. There are so many joys. And one of the biggest joys is watching other people come in and get well. It's very scary at first for some reason, and I'm not sure what that is, but people sharing their stories helped me so much more than studying and self-help courses and all the things where I was told what to do. Instead, listening to what other women and men as well could tell me that they had done, I could relate to that, and I could attempt to do those things in my own life. There's a fellowship that has evolved, and as is often said, we probably wouldn't all associate with one another somewhere else. But that need to live a whole different life is gone, and there's just so much more in my life that works. I make better decisions. I take better care of myself and those around me. And I don't think I would have ever found that without the help of Alcoholics Anonymous and the people in these rooms. Thanks for asking me to share.
Thanks, Sarah.
You're listening to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on air. If you want further information on Alcoholics Anonymous or to find out about AA meetings around the country, please go to aa.org.nz.
Paul, would you like to share, please?
Hi, everyone. I'm Paul, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Paul.
Hey, Paul.
Similarly, I grew up in a small town in a very large Catholic neighborhood, meaning that most families had sort of eight kids, and I was at the tail end, so there was a lot of older boys, which allowed us to get access to alcohol very young. And there was some dysfunction in my family as well, and so I think I was a bit of an anxious guy. When I first got access to it, I just thought it was magic, and I could not believe, even though it made me very ill the first time, and I think the last time that I ever got really ill from drinking, the only I was only thinking about the rewards. The consequences just were not there for me. And from that point on, I never got hangovers, which runs in my family. There's a long history of alcoholism in my family. And so I think whether it was nature or nurture, I think I was predisposed to not treating alcohol like some others. And my only thought was, when can we do this again? And I didn't drink a lot at the start because we were very young, but when I got access to it, I did drink, and I often drank too much. I would black out or pass out and end up in the bushes, but luckily nothing really bad happened for quite some time. Got into sport while I was in college age, and that kind of kept me out of trouble. I wouldn't drink when I was training and took it very seriously. So I managed to get all the way up to university really unscathed. And even though there would have been red flags, I think for other people, for me, it didn't really register that the way that I drank was always not socially. I went to university, and because of the dysfunction in my family, like was earlier shared, we were all overachievers and held ourselves to a very high standard and couldn't make mistakes. And so I went off to university thinking I was going to be a doctor and an Olympic athlete. When that died, when that dream died, I just did not have the coping skills to manage it. And I didn't really have a backup plan. And I immediately got back really into drinking heavily. And stayed that way for a number of years. The thing that appealed to me at first was that anxiety went away. I could be comfortable around people. I always had a fear of people, and when I drank, that seemed to disappear, especially around parties and things like that, any sort of social situation. And one thing I've found through being in this organization is that no one ever tells you at the start that it's going to change. And it often is fun and games at the start. And then by the time you sort of get dependent on it as a crutch, it's very difficult to turn back. And when things started stacking up for me, I really wasn't able to make that change. I tried a number of times to control my drinking. It would work for a little while, and I'd get sober for a little while, but I always sort of ended up in the same spot, and I just couldn't work it out. And one of the things that made it so challenging for me is that I was a good student. I wasn't, I, I was relatively bright. I was a good athlete. I had done, you know, I was pretty capable at stuff. Well, it turns out that most of the people I've met in AA are quite capable. And so that was really something that I had to come to grips with. You know, my idea of what an alcoholic was when I was a kid would be like a homeless person drinking cheap wine out of a bag in the park. I thought it was a really physical thing, and that you had to drink every day. So I've learned a lot, you know, since I came here. But the main thing was, after a big binge, my girlfriend at the time gently suggested I go see a counselor. And so I did, and I had a whole list of things, you know, that I was prepared to tell this person about, you know, why my life wasn't going so well. And after about 15 minutes, he sort of politely said, I think you should go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I was kind of floored because I thought my story was far more romantic than, you know, just having a problem with alcohol. But I did, you know, I took his advice because I didn't want to feel the way I'd been feeling for a number of years. Probably ever. And you know, I stumbled into a meeting and I was scared. I couldn't make eye contact with people. I couldn't talk to people. But what was clear from the start was that these people were speaking my language and they understood. Maybe like most other people didn't. And they were being honest. That just permeated the meeting. And they were happy. They were laughing. I thought it would just be grim, you know, but they were laughing. And, you know, luckily, I had just enough sense to stick around because when I got there, I saw things about spirituality on the wall. And I was raised in a Catholic church and I was an altar boy. And I was at a point in my life where that wasn't resonating with me anymore. And I didn't want to borrow that. But luckily, I just didn't want to feel like I was feeling anymore. And when they read out the promises, which they often do at meetings, and when you read them today, I heard it again. They talk about being happy. They talk about peace of mind. They talk about serenity. Those are things I wanted. And those were the things that I was actually chasing, drinking alcohol, right? As a young kid, those were the things I was after. And that's what I thought I was doing, was getting happy. But in the end, it made me miserable. And so, yeah, there are some things about those promises that have certainly come true for me. I've been sober 33 years now. And, you know, the main one is peace of mind. Life still comes at me. You know, there's still responsibilities. I have a wife and two grown boys now. And all of these things that I've gotten that give me peace of mind now are contingent on me being active. That's in that first sentence of the promises. It says something about action, you know. So I have to actually take on some responsibility for what I'm up to. But that the good part is I don't have to do this alone. You know, there's lots of people here that had succeeded in learning how to be, first of all, not to drink, but also then pursue things beyond that. In terms of just how to treat other people, how to not be just self-obsessed all the time. I was so driven by, you know, being uber successful as a young person, that if I wasn't highly successful, it meant that I was highly unsuccessful. And I had a lot of black and white thinking around stuff like that. And that's changed so much from coming in here. Two things that really have helped me in this, and they go a lot towards the promises, and that is acceptance and attachment. You know, I used to attach myself, and I used to worry about stuff and the outcomes of things so much. And as it turns out, most of the stuff that people worry about never manifest. You know, they never come to be. And so if I don't get so wound up and I don't try to manipulate people, manipulate situations and things like that, then I find that I'm a lot less disappointed or angry or wound up about what the outcomes are. And, it's just been a huge change, like a complete 180 from the way that I approached life before. And, you know, that self-knowledge, you know, thinking that I was a bright young guy, it actually hindered my ability to just be humble enough to be open-minded to another way of life. And I've found it here. You know, this literally saved my life. But beyond that, because I believe I wouldn't be alive right now, the way that I drank was extremely dangerous. I got in a lot of trouble and luckily didn't kill anyone or myself in the process. But I'm convinced that beyond that, all of these opportunities that I have nowadays are as a result of me just being sober. If I just don't drink, and that's, you know, at first I was upset about that. I felt like it was some sort of curse that this was a health condition that I had, and why me? But I've come to actually appreciate it because it has opened up the opportunity for me to do all the other stuff in life. And I thought my life would get boring if I stopped drinking, but actually the opposite happened. It got very full of really enjoyable stuff. So I'm really grateful to the people in this program. Thanks for asking me to share.
Thank you, Paul.
You are listening to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on air. If you want more information or help to stop drinking, please call 0800 229 6757 or go to the website aa.org.nz.
Peter, would you like to share, please?
Yeah. Hi, I'm Peter and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Peter.
Hi, Peter.
And thank you for all the good things I've heard so far in this meeting. I grew up in a almost teetotal household, really. There were drinkers in my extended family, but at home it was almost unknown. But I took to it like a duck to water. From the very first time I had a drink of alcohol, I hated the taste and loved the feeling. The first time I got unfettered access to an alcohol cabinet when I was babysitting my brother's three children. They came home and found me passed out on the living room floor in a pool of vomit. So it could have been my last time, really, as well. And I carried on like that. I started having blackouts, I think the first one when I was about 20. And it scared me. And unfortunately, my close friend that I spoke to the next day and said, you know, I can't remember a thing about what happened last night. It was at a party. And he said, don't worry, you were just really, really funny and this, you know, it's all good. And I sort of clung to that for the next 35 years. I had other blackouts over the years and I had lots of drunken escapades, which I won't go into here, but I was generally a very happy, sociable drinker. And I'm only a little guy, so I avoided physical confrontations mostly. I'd like to say I got into a couple of fights, but actually I got thumped a couple of times, and that was the end of that. And I disgraced myself often, thinking that I was being really, really witty when I was actually just being embarrassing. Anyway, I eventually hit a very painful rock bottom when someone close to me died, and I misbehaved yet another time at the wake for that person and realized that I had to do something about my drinking. The way I remember it is I actually fell to my knees. I was outside by myself having a cigarette, drunk, and I fell and had to grasp a tree that was in front of me to stop me hitting the ground, and just had the thought, this has got to stop. I phoned a friend, someone I didn't know that well at the time, who I now know extremely well, the next day, and said, look, I've really got to do something about my drinking. And that person said they would meet me outside an AA meeting the next day, and did. And I'm one of the lucky ones because I haven't had a drink since, and I just clocked up 20 years sobriety a few weeks ago. So the theme of this meeting is the promises. And the promises begin something like, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. And I guess that's definitely come true for me. I was amazed before I was halfway through. That the word painstaking is very important, I think, if we're going to, you know, get the most out of AA. just like everything in life, the more you put into it, the more you get out of it. And if you're painstaking about working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you get the results. And I have. And there's a whole list of things in the promises that it says will come true. The one that often sticks in my mind when we hear them or read them is it says we will intuitively know how to handle situations that sometimes baffled us. And in my time in AA in the last decade or so, I've lost a couple of people that I was very close to. And instead of doing what I would have done if I had still been drinking and done a lot of drunken crying about how horrible it was that they were dying and why does this have to happen to me, losing these people and all of that, I was able to actually be a big part of the last part of their lives and spend a lot of time with them and think about the best things I could do for them and their loved ones rather than woe is me, I'm losing this great person. So that's one of the many things that AA has given me that I'm extremely grateful for. And it's got lots and lots of things to recommend it, and one of them is that you meet such great people and get to know them. And I'm sitting in a room full of them right now, and very grateful for that, for being sober and for being a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks, Peter.
You're listening to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on air. If you want further information on Alcoholics Anonymous or to find out about AA meetings around the country, please go to aa.org.nz.
Mary, would you like to share, please?
Thanks, Kim. I'm Mary and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Mary.
Hi, Mary.
And I'm a very grateful alcoholic. And that seems impossible for me to think now, because when I first came into this program, and it's a few years ago now, I used to hear people say, I'm a grateful alcoholic. And I thought, such was my thinking, oh, God, how pathetic. How could you be a grateful alcoholic? How could you be grateful that you could no longer drink again and have all those good times that you used to have as an alcoholic? And what I realised, and what I've come to realise through my time in this program, is that my thinking has had to change, and my thinking has been changed through exposure to these 12 steps and the messages that I constantly get and the people and the changes that I see in others. And the promises tell us that we will come to know a new freedom and a new happiness. And the irony is that when I was a drinker, I thought I was free. I thought I was free to do anything, say anything, treat anybody how I liked, and that somehow constituted freedom. And I was also slightly informed, not slightly, more than informed, by feminism. So I thought it was my role as a drinking alcoholic to assert the rights of women in every situation. And, you know, that wasn't very helpful for me or for any people I may have been wanting to convert to the cause, because I was drunk, I was foul-mouthed. I thought that I could behave as men behaved, and so that would prove that I was somehow equal to them. Such was the perverted thinking of the drinking alcoholic. And the new freedom that I have come to understand through the fellowship of AA is that the only thing that I can't do in my life now is drink. And not only do I can't do it, I don't want to do it either. But as a drinking alcoholic, and in Alcoholics Anonymous, we talk about the bondage of self. And that, to me, means an utter obsession with and self-centeredness about what I do, what I think, and my opinion, and all of those things are deeply important. And when I was drinking, that is all I thought about. I did only think about myself. There was the thinking about drinking, but there was also the absolute absence of thoughtfulness towards others. And when I was drinking in a country overseas, and it was before cell phones and toll calls were really expensive, and my mother used to write faithfully to me, and I would, you know, I would sometimes reply, but often I wouldn't. And one time she was so worried about me that she went through a very convoluted process to make contact with somebody to find out how I was. And that, you know, that is the bondage of self. That was the, that's what it meant, that I had no thought for anybody else when I was drinking, or for, you know, for the concern or pain that I might be causing others. Never registered. And so the freedom from the bondage of self is an enormous freedom that I have gained within this fellowship. That I, because I'm no longer obsessed with drinking, which took up a lot of time, yeah, it took a lot of time and thought, drinking, but I have also been given the gift or the grace to be able to think of others, to be able to walk beside others, to be able to help others. Well, that that never occurred to me as a drinking alcoholic, that I could spend time with other people and with no, what do they say, you know, no thought of return, but certainly within the context of AA, the return that we get by helping others, it helps our own sobriety, it strengthens my own sobriety, never mind the sheer joy that you can get from seeing somebody come into these rooms broken and get this program and stick at it and change their lives, you know. And it also tells us in the promises that we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. And I did regret my past, you know, I did regret that deep selfishness. I did regret that deep disrespect for myself, but for others. I did regret that I ended up, you know, in my late 20s with not a brass razoo to my name. I did regret a lot of the stuff that I had done as a drinking alcoholic. So I found it difficult to believe that you could come to a point where you didn't regret your past, nor wish to shut the door on it. But through the process of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's four of them, the step four and five are the ones that where we do deal with our past, and we are then given the grace to let it go somehow. Step four is we made a fearless and searching moral inventory of ourselves. And then the fifth is that we admitted to God, as we understand him, ourselves and another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. Exact nature of our wrongs. It's pretty scary. but we have, you know, well, it was my experience that I had to make that fearless moral inventory and to admit, it's much easier to admit it to some God of your understanding, you know, because it's only you and them and your God doesn't answer back or anything like that. But when it's another human being, that makes it a whole other thing, and the exact nature of your wrongs. And it's through that process, you know, I hadn't admitted the exact nature of my wrongs to anybody. But it is that process that enables us to shut, you know, to not regret the past or wish to shut the door on it, because that past and what it did to me and my understanding of it is what enables me to help another woman broken who comes in through our doors, you know, and the exact nature of their wrongs is terrifying to them, is terrible, and to think of having to admit it to somebody else is just the most ghastly thing. But I can truly say I know how that feels, and it's okay. It's okay, you know, and there is, you know, that's, you know, that is a great gift of this fellowship, but it also, you know, it I don't regret my past now any longer, and I've said sorry to the people that I did so disrespect, to those, you know, those that I can, and we will know, you know, we'll, the word serenity, and we will know peace, and it's through that process that we come to know, that I have come to know the word serenity and understand what peace means. And for me, it means, you know, it's an internal, it's my interior and self that I don't have to live in that chaos. That, I mean, there was the physical chaos, kind of, you know, like the environmental chaos that you created around you, and I was sick. I was very sick when I came into these rooms, and everything in my world was chaotic, including my head. You know, there was just, so the serenity has come through, and the peace is internally. You know that, and I never imagined that would happen. The person that came in these rooms, and it is a gift. You know, it is the gift of this fellowship that I have come to know the word serenity and understand peace. And, you know, fear of financial insecurity will leave us. That's another promise. And when I came in here, I had nothing, you know, except debt. I had debt, and I had very kindly parents who were prepared, you know, for me to live with them as I tried to start a new life back here in New Zealand as a drunk, struggling to stay sober within the fellowship. And before I came into the fellowship, they were happy to have me, until they weren't. And I remember I'd had a terrible night, another one, and I was supposed to go to work, and I got my mother to ring up my boss and say that I was sick. And she came into the bedroom and she was shaking her head and she said, "I'm never going to do that for you again." And she never did. And I got into these rooms by the grace of the God of my understanding, by colleagues at work who saw me at my worst, you know, at my worst hungover. They made me appointments, they took me to them. And so it was nothing to do with me. You know, I didn't think, oh, I got to do something about my alcoholism. My colleagues did, and my family. And, you know, I came into these rooms unwillingly and disbelievingly and with no money. And so fear of financial insecurity has left me. And the reason that it has left me is because through this program, I was kind of reconstructed as a person. I was rebuilt as a person. Physically, I became much weller. Psychologically, the chaos internally calmed down, not immediately and not all the time. Some can sometimes return, but I have the ability now through these steps to deal with that stuff, and I could work properly. I mean, that was another, you know, we look for the similarities, not the differences. And I heard in the rooms, you know, a lot of people lost their jobs, lost their licenses, etc. I never did. I never lost my job, or I never lost a license. I should have lost my job. I should have lost my license, but I didn't. So that was a difference that I, because I always was looking for differences to prove that I wasn't an alcoholic. But, you know, through this program, I became a decent employee. So I was able to pay back my debts and start saving. And, you know, thankfully, that fear of ever being in a situation where I had nothing again left me. And over the time that I've been in this program, the promises have been fulfilled for me. and continue to be fulfilled for me. But what I do know is that if I stray from this program, if I decide that I don't need to keep up my meetings as regularly as I used to, I start unraveling around the edges. You know, I start, the chaos can start coming in, the fears about what might happen or how I'm going to cope with it, or what if something terrible happens to somebody I love, that, you know, I need to keep close to the program to keep those promises being fulfilled in my life, to keep it true that I have the new freedom, the happiness, the serenity, the freedom from fear, the new outlook on life, because I am an alcoholic. And it says I suffer from alcoholism, and hear it in these rooms, it's not alcoholism, it's alcoholism, which means I, self, me. And that's what I can slip back into that bondage of self on so many levels if I stay away from this program. And in many ways, it's easy to stick to this program, and it's, you know, the steps and the totality that makes this up when things are going well in life, and mostly they do. You know, I'm very, very lucky. I feel that I you know, reap the rewards of this program every day. But when things go wrong, and I think that that I am challenged in this program, and that it's harder to stick at it, and it's harder to believe. And what I'm told by wiser people is that we just must believe more deeply, and that can be really hard when there's stuff in your life that you don't want happening, and you don't want it happening for you, or more so for others. And the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable. And I came to believe that. I didn't believe it at first, but, you know, I did come to believe that. But I also know that I am still powerless over many, many aspects of my life and the lives of others. And I want things to be different for people. I want them not to be having to go what they're going through, or whatever the case may be, but that is outside my control. I am powerless over that, and I have to accept that. And that, I find that can be a difficult spiritual challenge for me at times. And what I have to do to rise to that challenge, or to be able to gain the level of acceptance about a situation that I don't want it to be like that. I don't want it to be like that. But I have no power. I have no control. I have to let go and let God, is the saying in AA. We let go and let God. And that is, for me, it is a spiritual exercise. It is not something I can simply do alone. I have to be given the grace to do that. And where I find the grace to do that is in these rooms with other alcoholics who know that. Every alcoholic, or, you know, in every room, there will be somebody who has experienced great loss in their lives and have got through it without drinking. So I can look at them and think, or I can ask them, how did you do it? You know, and it's always the same. I kept going to meetings, you know, I kept believing that all would be well. And that's what I have to do. And I have to admit my own powerlessness on a daily basis if I am to maintain that serenity that this program promises. I have to believe more deeply if I am going to keep that serenity and come to that acceptance that it may be not what I want, but it is what it is. And, you know, simply put, in the program, we say we must live life on life's terms. And life's terms can be hard at times. If not for me, for other people, they can be hard. And when they are hard for me, what I have to do is believe more deeply. I have to keep coming back here into these rooms more regularly to keep hearing the wisdom and the knowledge and the understanding and the love and the principles and gifts of this program, to be able to live life on life's terms with serenity and with peace of mind. And I sometimes feel sorry for people who don't have this program, because I don't know how they cope with this, with stuff. I don't know how they live life on life's terms when those terms are really tough, when they're really hard, because this is what I've got to fall back on, this program, thank God, and it is there for me. And, you know, I wish it were there for everybody who walks in the doors of AA, but again, I'm powerless over that. I can only share my message and hope and pray that they get this program and keep coming back, and that their lives will change too, and that they can see that there is a life, a full life that is so worth living. And the only thing is you can't pour piss down your throat anymore. You know, that's the only thing. And that their lives can be transformed, as mine have been, and as I've heard today in this meeting, and I hear every day, or at every meeting, that transformation. And I feel so glad that the unwilling, disbelieving, cynical, sarcastic, mouthy person, woman who walked in these doors not thinking that I needed it, was given the grace to stay long enough to sense and feel the change. And there's another saying in AA that is, don't leave before the miracle happens. And I'm very, very glad I didn't. Thanks, Kim, for asking me to share.
Thanks, Mary.
Thanks, Mary.
Thank you, everyone. That brings us to the end of our meeting on air. And thank you all very much for coming along and for sharing. We will now close with three of our 12 traditions and the Serenity Prayer. Tradition 1, personal recovery depends on AA unity. Tradition 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Tradition 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. And if we'd all like to join in to do the Serenity Prayer, please. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast on Fresh FM with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community access media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.net, for our contact details.